Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. What does a fever have to do with autism? And how might the bacteria in the gut change autism symptoms? These are a few of the questions we'll explore today on Think with Dr. Richard Fry. He's director of autism research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. Dr. Fry, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So this story begins with a little boy in Dallas who we featured on KERA's Breakthroughs series in May. And a note, we've agreed to change the boy's name to protect his privacy. Matt could read before he could speak.
I had suspected this when we would read stories and he would turn the pages. But I had just assumed he just knows when it's time to turn the page.
John Rodakis is Matt's dad. He's 46, and he spent much of his career as a medical venture capitalist. And as you'll see, Rodakis loves to run experiments.
We actually ended up doing this little experiment where we got this like Etch-a-Sketch board. My wife wrote the word run, R-U-N, and held it up and showed it to him, and he ran around the couch.
Run! Run, bear!
And then she wrote the word dance, and he would do a dance.
In a home video, Matt is giggling and running around, a white diaper sticking out of the top of his green striped pajamas. At age 2, Matt had this extraordinary ability to read without training. It's called hyperlexia, and usually it's associated with autism.
But at the time, our son was happy, he was engaged, he was loving. And so we thought, well, maybe he's just one of those super rare hyperlexics that's not also autistic.
Not long after, Rodakis and his wife, Christy, noticed a serious change.
Within the course of a month, he basically stopped making eye contact. He became quite rigid, meaning sort of an insistence on sameness. And when things didn't go the way he wanted, you know, he would throw fits and temper tantrums.
Matt, who's now 5, was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. 1 in 68 children has it. Symptoms vary greatly among kids. Classic features are impaired communication, poor social engagement, and repetitive behavior. Now, before we go on with the story, a warning. Autism is one of the most divisive medical conditions there is. It separates scientists from scientists and parents from parents because after decades of research, we still don't know what causes it. And when you don't know the cause of a disorder, you don't know how to treat it. You don't know how to help kids like Matt.
Dr. Fry, there have been some powerful waves of thinking about what causes autism. In the 70s, it was bad parenting, then vaccines, which we'll touch on in a moment. But what is the thinking today about what's behind autism?
Well, there still is a lot of research that needs to be done as far as the causes of autism. There's a lot of work that's gone into genetics, and we know that there are certain genetic models and genetic diseases where you see autistic behavior. However, what we're becoming aware of is that that's only one piece of the puzzle. Some of the studies that have come out have shown that there's really very tight links between a genetic vulnerability and environmental interactions. That is that that probably you have certain vulnerabilities that you're born with, and that there's another series of things that you're exposed to that that may pull the trigger to cause some change in development. And what's really very interesting, I think, is that as we learn more about more environmental types of causes, we find that there's things that we didn't expect. That is that a lot of times when people think of environment, they think of certain types of pollutants or toxins. But what we're really finding is that the environment is really broad, and it has to do with the bacteria that's in your gut, the so-called microbiome. It also has to do with the maternal environment, what you were exposed to when you were developing in your mother's womb. And we're starting to understand that certain conditions that may have affected the mother may affect the way the baby develops. So that's another example of environment. And then, of course, there's certain types of nutritional aspects of your environment, and other certain other things that she'd been exposed to, including infectious agents.
Now, before we move on, let's tackle that vaccine idea. How do you respond to parents when they ask if vaccines might have caused their child's autism?
Well, I think, the vaccine question is really a very contentious debate, and many people get very emotional with the idea of vaccines and their connection to autism. And one thing I really think is it's a real example of the vacuum that we have of knowing what the causes are of autism. And I think until we have more science and the science moves forward and we can find the really nail down the causes of autism and what the series of events are that result in autism, we're going to leave open these debates that, may not be solvable at this point.
And so if not just environment or just genetics, there is some genetics involved, and different percentages are attributed to that. But what do you think about how many cases of autism are traced back to genetics?
So what it looks like is the numbers. So when you talk about genetics, it seems like it's a simple word. That is, you think about kind of inherited disease, the genetics that you get from your parents or the genes that you get from your parents. But it's really a more complicated issue. Kind of simple syndromic type of genetics seems to account for somewhere about 20% of the cases of autism. And it may be that up to maybe another 30% or so have genes involved, but in very complicated ways, or that they're involved with environmental triggers. So, there's many cases where genetics are involved, but at different levels. And the other really kind of interesting thing about genetics and what we find in autism is, we always, or at least I think a lot of people assume that when you talk about genetics, this is you think about something that's been inherited from your parents. And what we find is that many of the genetic disorders that we find in children with autism are not inherited. They're so-called de novo. That is, they didn't specifically come from their parents' genome, but it was their parents' genome that was changed along the way, possibly because of errors in the way that the cell maintains genes or other types of environmental exposures that may have caused errors in copying of the genes. So so it's a complicated picture, and I think genetics is something that really has to be taken in the context of the broader scope of how it interacts with the environment and other factors.
And you point out that really a lot of diseases that we're exploring are linked to genetics, but that isn't the sole cause, for example, with diabetes or heart disease or things like that.
I think it's a really great point. And I think it's one of the things that we can benefit from research in autism. That is that these types of diseases where we have genetics and environmental interactions that lead to disease are probably account for most of the diseases that we know. And until we understand these complicated interactions, we're not going to be able to cure these diseases. So in that sense, even research into these interactions in autism can tell us about broader ranges of diseases and help us find cures for other diseases.
So John Rodakis, the Dallas father, and his wife, they accepted the idea that their son had a genetic mutation. That was essentially what they were told. And they did what many parents do. They took him to therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy. But eventually, they started to question the conventional view of autism as they saw it, and they began to notice their son's symptoms changed depending on environmental factors like what he ate and what medicines he took. The first clue, the father Rodakis says, happened when Matt got a fever. So we'll call it the fever effect.
We observed that when our son would have a fever, we would notice these kind of transient improvements in his speech and his mood and in his eye contact. And it was noticeable enough that I went to the medical literature to see if there was anything about this, and sure enough, there was.
Dr. Fry, have you heard parents describe something like this to you, a change after or during a fever?
Yes, and it's pretty good. There's some documentation. I wouldn't say there's excellent documentation, but there's really nice study done by Andy Zimmerman, who right now is up at University of Massachusetts. He did the study when he was at Kennedy Krieger in Baltimore, and that is the Johns Hopkins Institute. And he showed that certain children with autism, when they have a fever, seem to have improvements in behavior and also cognition and language. And he did it in a very elegant way that was somewhat convincing that this might be an actual true effect. And then what he's done recently is he's actually shown that there actually might be a treatment that's linked to these specific subset of children with autism. So it's really a nice example of finding this subset of children with autism that may have some specific change in their cells that may involve a specific pathway, and then finding a treatment that may be able to modulate that specific pathway to improve their function.
And it's fascinating, too, because the treatment that he looked into has to do with a broccoli sprouts extract, which if you tell any kid that they need to eat or take, sounds like the worst possible medicine.
Yeah, luckily it's something that can be produced, and you don't have to actually get kids to eat their broccoli if they don't want to.
Yeah.
And his study was very impressive. I mean, he found he recruited mostly adolescent males that had the fever effect and showed that this simple treatment, which is really well tolerated, resulted in some dramatic improvements. Of course, you know, it's the beginning probably of a series of studies and more has to be done. And we don't know how many children with autism, what the range of that subset is. But with the rates of autism, you know, even a subset of 5-10%, if you can find the treatment that will improve their lives, is really very miraculous.
So what does the study indicate at the larger scale if we step back? Why is it powerful to say that there's a way to change autism symptoms?
Well, because in one of the things that we find, especially in children that don't respond to behavioral educational treatments, and of course, you know, the standard treatments that like Mr. Radakis was using for his son, behavioral educational treatments are the standard of care and are definitely first line for any child with autism. And if a child responds to those treatments and develops what we call optimal outcomes, that's really wonderful. But we know that's the minority of children. And many children get left with a range of deficits that go on to affect them throughout life. They can be anywhere from mildly affected to very severely affected. And that puts a very large burden on not only the individual, but the family. And that's one of the things I think that parents worry about so much when their child isn't making significant improvements. They want to know what is going to happen to their child when they're gone, who's going to care for them. I think it's important that if we find a treatment that can even improve them to a level where they can live independently, it would be really a tremendous advantage.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, filling in this week for Chris Boyd. We're talking today with Dr. Richard Fry. He's a child neurologist and director of autism research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, by emailing think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Dr. Fry after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in this week for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Fry. He's director of autism research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. Dr. Fry, we're talking about some of the clues that led a Dallas dad to question conventional wisdom about autism. And the first clue that triggered this journey was what we called the fever effect. Whenever his toddler had a fever, his autism symptoms seemed to improve. Now, clue number two came in the form of pills. So we'll call it the antibiotic effect. Essentially, a few days after starting amoxicillin for strep throat, Rodakis says his normally quiet kid began speaking more articulately and seemed to have more energy. And then on day six of the treatment,
I hear a tricycle behind me and I whip around and I see my son riding that tricycle around like a normal little 3.5-year-old. And you might say, well, what's so remarkable about that? Well, up until that day, he had never so much as been able to push the pedal enough on that tricycle to move it forward. It's like the veil of autism just was lifted magically.
Dr. Fry, do you think that this was imagined, this improvement?
No, I don't think it was imagined. I think it was a real effect. And I think that parents definitely are the best observers of their own child because they know their own child. And when you hear this from a parent, it could be something, some fluctuation in child's symptoms, but I think you have to take it seriously and think about what could have caused this. Now, as Mr. Rodakis says in his story, of course, his child was sick, so there may have been a fever involved, and he was given an antibiotic. And you may think that an antibiotic only has one effect, that is the effect that we intend it to have in killing bacteria, but it may have many different effects. Antibiotics themselves can have effects on metabolic systems in the cells of our body, but more importantly, and we think this is kind of a side effect, one of the side effects of antibiotics many times is you have an upset stomach and sometimes you go to the bathroom a lot. And this is probably, and this is pretty much known to be due to a change in the gut bacteria that lives in our body. And one of the things that's what we're really realizing, which is pretty extraordinary, is that there's 10 times more bacteria in our gut than there are cells in our body. So you can even think of yourself as kind of a vessel to carry around bacteria because there's more of them than there are of you. all joking aside, it does suggest that they may have a really vital function. And the more we research the role of bacteria in the gut, we're realizing that they do have a very essential function in both metabolism and actually programming the immune system. And there's lots of studies now that have shown that by manipulating gut bacteria, we actually can change behavior and metabolic systems within our body. This really has implications for not only neurodevelopmental disorders like autism, but other things like obesity and diabetes.
Now, the only scientific study I came across that's looked at antibiotics and autism is one from the late 90s. What did that study show?
So that study was based on the premise that there's a certain type of bacteria that may be overgrown, or maybe there's too much of it in the guts of children with autism. And there's some small studies that showed that initially, and there's other studies now that have confirmed this. And so what those researchers did, they wanted to target this particular type of bacteria, Clostridia, with a certain antibiotic called vancomycin. And vancomycin is a good antibiotic for targeting this specific bacteria because when it's given orally, it's not absorbed into the body. So it will just affect the bacteria that's in the gut. It won't affect the cells in the body. It won't affect anything else in the body. And what they showed is that with this treatment, they showed improvements in behavior after giving the antibiotic for a transient time.
That is to say that the symptoms sort of reverted back to what they had been after the antibiotic effect wore off.
Exactly.
And the results from that study were impressive, but they were also somewhat controversial.
Well, you know, I think this is where we have a lot of controversy in autism itself, because if autism was caused by something that was obvious and fell into the kind of box that we know about in medicine, we would have probably solved it by now. But it's clear that really we're launching into a new frontier. And whenever you go into a new frontier and you have different ideas, I think people get uncomfortable with it and it becomes controversial. And, of course, one of the issues is that some of those ideas may be right and some of those ideas might be wrong. And that's where we really need the research to really take those best ideas and put them through well-controlled trials so we know what the best treatments are. So this was a very small study, and so it was limited. It did not use some of the standards that we have now for rating behavior and doing certain types of measurements of cognition. And in its defense of the study, it was a very early study where those tools weren't really developed. And many of the tools to study autism, rate autistic behaviors, are still being developed, and the standards aren't complete at this time. So really, it's a process.
Now, the third clue for John Rodakis was different. It was about food, as you talk about bacteria in the gut as well. So first, remember, we had the fever effect. Then there was this antibiotic effect. And now let's look at the food factor.
So the first thing that we tried was we took gluten out of his diet. And we didn't really see any improvements. Later, we tried taking dairy out of his diet, and within about 3 days, we saw pretty dramatic improvements in speech and in eye contact.
How might food influence behavior in some kids with autism?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about the gluten-free, casein-free diet that many children are on.
And casein is dairy, essentially, right?
It is. It is. And what it seems to be, as we've studied this more and more, that there's probably two different effects. They probably affect subsets of children with autism. And it's probably not autism only. You know, there's many people that their children go on a gluten-free diet and they go on a gluten-free diet and they feel much better themselves. And what we're learning is that gluten has many different effects, and there may actually be a receptor in the gut that actually modulates gut permeability that gluten actually can modulate. And so in some individuals that are sensitive, it may very well affect the gut directly. And then there's casein, milk products, as you say. And that's another really interesting area. Milk really has many different proteins in it and has many other nutrients in it. And sometimes people are sensitive to certain nutrients, but sometimes there's certain proteins that are the body can be very sensitive to. And we know in some of our studies that there's a certain autoantibody that is involved in folate metabolism, blocks folate metabolism, that is increased in the body when you have when you drink milk. And going on a milk-free diet actually decreases this autoantibody in the blood and actually is therapeutic. Milk itself, because of many of the different nutrients and it also can have other effects, and some people can be sensitive to those. So in some ways, it actually could affect the gut, could cause inflammation possibly.
So do you recommend for parents to experiment with these types of things since, as you said, we do not have a cure for autism and each individual is so different, do you tell them, hey, why don't you try a gluten or a casein or dairy-free diet and see what happens?
Well, it all depends on the parent and the child. Each individual family and each individual with autism is very different. We do recommend, if they're interested in it, as something that they try. Anything that we recommend that they try is not something that we say will definitely work, because we really don't know many times what will work for what child. So we try to systematically try different things, including the diet, if the parents are interested, with the guidance of a dietitian, to see if their child will react. And some children do react. Some families and parents find it too much of a burden to actually implement the diet, in which case it's probably not going to be useful for that child.
You can call 1-800-933-5372 with your questions or comments. Mark in Dallas.
Oh, hi. I've been enjoying this discussion. My question is related to the diet and antibiotics. Increasingly, you know, a lot of the dairy producers, they keep pushing milk, and you'll see it more and more these days, again and again, on kids. Which is not a natural part of the diet. Then you'll see high fructose processed foods, and then you'll also see antibiotics given just increasingly by doctors whenever they go in for their visits. They're not replenishing their gut bacteria, consistently, and we have pasteurization of foods and that sort of thing. Do you think that would be one of the major roles that is playing in this increasing pathology of the disease of autism?
Thanks, Mark.
Go ahead. A really great question. Of course, the one of the problems with trying to figure out what's resulting in the apparent rise in autism is the fact that so much has changed in society. And it may not be one thing. It may be several different things. It's important, I think, for health. And it's not just autism, but I think in general health, we're realizing that gut bacteria is really important and that we shouldn't be depleting them, and that probiotics do have a role. I think it's something that's really developing. The standards for probiotics are something that are developing, knowing when to use certain probiotics. I could foresee in the future where when we give certain antibiotics, we follow it up with certain probiotics so that we're able to have minimal side effects on our guts and maybe limiting antibiotic use. And that's been a trend for several decades to try and limit antibiotic use. But, of course, in a practical sense, sometimes it's a difficult thing to do in the clinic.
Yeah, it is. And you have to be careful going out there. There's lots of marketing efforts that try and get you to buy this probiotic or that probiotic. And as you said, the standards aren't really clear on what will work yet, right?
Exactly. But it is encouraging. There's more and more research on probiotics. And I think more and more we're starting to see people take it seriously, the idea seriously. Mm-hmm. So the trials are being done so we can answer that question of what's the right probiotic and what's the right situation to use it in.
And now our microbiome, as this popular term that we're hearing more and more, the bacteria that live in and on us, is formed from what I understand large part while we're in the womb. And we have a tweet here. Someone's asking whether there's any advice you have, Dr. Fry, on for expecting parents about things they can do to decrease autism risks. Are there any proven protective therapies?
Well, it's an absolute wonderful question, and we're hoping that research really goes in that direction, in the sense that we really want to find treatments for children with autism. But one of the ultimate goals is to prevent autism from actually occurring. How do we do that? Well, we do know that there are certain risk factors associated with developing autism. One of the biggest studies that came out, actually two studies, showed that prenatal folate is really, really important for for preventing autism, and not only prenatal folate, preconception folate. And although, you know, the data isn't in to say that that we have absolute evidence of what's going to be the best way of reducing, you know, autism risk with concerning pregnancy, I think some of the real best guidelines is to try to make sure that before you become pregnant, you're very healthy, you're well nourished, that your body has the minimal number of medical conditions, you expose yourself to the minimal numbers of both toxins and food. That is, it probably is not a bad idea to eat more organic vegetables and meats where there's less exposure to antibiotics and other toxins there. And it's probably best to limit your exposure to medications, including just common medications like acetaminophen.
Oh, really? Why would that help?
Well, there's been, again, there's just preliminary data, but there are some linkages that suggest that certain types of common medications, both prescription medications and over-the-counter medications, may increase the risk of developing autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders. So I think it's important, you know, you can do this kind of in a practical sense. Of course, you have to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. But just to be on the safe side, it's probably best to try and expose your body to the least number of non-natural substances that we have. And I think and keep yourself healthy. Make sure you go into a pregnancy healthy. And make sure, you know, try to plan the pregnancy. Make sure you get prenatal care.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman. In this week for Chris Boyd, we're talking today with Dr. Richard Fry. He's a child neurologist and director of autism research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, by emailing think@kera.org, or by sending me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Dr. Fry after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Dr. Richard Fry. He's a child neurologist and director of autism research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. So in the search for answers about autism, parents are often the ones diving in headfirst, as we've been listening to the story of this Dallas father. Dr. Fry, is the role of a parent any different in handling autism than it might be for handling another disorder, say bipolar disorder or ADHD?
Well, I think I think it is, and I think that disorders, particularly which are in kind of the category of psychiatric disorders, are particularly very stressful on the family, and for a number of reasons. One, because they involve an inability for an individual really to communicate and understand as well, but also because of the fact that we know so little about them, that we don't have a clear understanding of what comes in the future and what the best way of treating them really is. So I think it's really a struggle for the family, because many families struggle to find answers, and many times there's not some type of one magic bullet we have to actually fix the disorder, and many times it's a process of finding out what would be the best thing to help a child.
What can parents do to help doctors help their kids? I know the father, John Rodakis, kept very almost obsessive track of some of the details of his son's behavior. I know everyone can't do that.
Right. I mean, it's a great question. And I think that it is important. One of the most important things I think families can do is to get involved in support groups and talk to other people that are experiencing what they're experiencing, to learn more, to learn what the right questions are to ask, learn what the right things are to look for, and to talk to their doctors about these things. It's also, very important if possible to keep very good notes and very good records. Usually, evaluations for children with autism are very extensive, medical records aren't the most organized things, although you would like to think that they would be. Many of the systems there don't give doctors the access to all of the information that they'd like to have. And a parent that has all of the records organized and can discuss them with the doctor and bring them to the appointment is definitely makes the appointment with the doctor very optimal and allows everybody to get the most out of it they can.
You can join our conversation. Call 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk to Sean in Dallas.
Oh, hey, amen to all that you just said, Dr. Fry. And I have a couple of questions. What changes would you like to see in autism funding, research, and treatment? And do you think there's any hope in brain research that could possibly save lives of people with autism and even intellectual disabilities in a significant way?
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, great question. I think that there's a lot of hope. I think that the more we find and the more we discover, the more we're going to understand how to treat and prevent all types of neurodevelopmental, psychiatric, and other disorders. And so I think the future holds a lot of hope. I think at this point, though, we really need funding to look beyond the basic science. I think many times medical research looks at kind of the basic science using animal models and doesn't escalate new ideas fast enough that we can actually apply them to the people that need them. And so I think there's a substantial need for funding to look into translational research, where we can actually take treatments that may be helpful and try them out quickly in clinical trials to find out if they would be helpful. I think there's a lot of research that needs to be done to understand what the causes of autism, including what these environmental factors what their role is and how they interact with the genetic predisposition, so we can understand why this is occurring. And that will help us really understand how to prevent it. And I think a lot of research needs to go into looking into prevention. As I had mentioned, there's some information we have about possibilities of things that are linked to autism. But it may not be that strong, but I think that it doesn't prevent us from trying to change the way that we live our lives, especially how a woman that's pregnant, what things that she is exposed to and what things can be done to optimize the neurodevelopment of the child. And that can be done in controlled clinical trials if we really have the resources and the will to do it.
And on that topic, someone wrote in, Sandra, who wanted to know if you have advice, and maybe you don't, but you can point this person in the right direction, about what is the optimal amount of time for rest before conception, or what are the guidelines to really do as much prevention as possible?
Sure. Unfortunately, we haven't developed great guidelines Yet there has been a few attempts to do so, and there are groups that are developing guidelines that will help women specifically have something to go to allow them to have a reference. But we do know that a short interpregnancy interval does increase the risk of developing autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders, and so and so probably, you know, pregnancy should be separated by at least 2 years. And of course, what's most important is to plan the pregnancy and make sure that your health both physically and emotionally and is optimal, and that you have the right family support.
Now, developing guidelines and doing research obviously takes funding and money. And Jennifer in Dallas had asked, what is the best way, if you do want to support this research into autism, where should you contribute, to a charity or to some other scientific organization?
Well, there's many different organizations that are looking into this, and there's many organizations that are trying to find the answers. At Arkansas Children's Hospital, you know, we're developing a program to be very comprehensive, to develop not only looking at the basic science, but actually taking the basic science and translating it to treatments and bringing it into our clinic, and also taking what we find in the clinic and using those clues to go back to the laboratory. We're also working on ways of hopefully developing programs to prevent autism and increase maternal health. We're one program, but there's many different programs and many different foundations. And one thing I would say is that if you're going to give your money to, it's important to do the research to make sure your money goes to the place that you want it to go, and that the organization that you give it to has a track record of completing the mission that you want them to.
That's a good point. You don't want it to end without any results at least being published somewhere for people to look at and share. And you're currently working on research looking at the connections between autism and mitochondrial disease. What does this involve, and what are mitochondria?
The mitochondria are thought of as the powerhouses of the cell. In each of your cells, you have anywhere from 100 to tens of thousands of mitochondria, depending on how much energy your cell needs. The mitochondria is not only important for making energy for the cell to function, but it also is the center of metabolism of the cell. That is, how the cell makes its building blocks and gets rid of its wastes, I like to describe it as. And what we're finding is that there's a subset of children that have problems with the way that this mitochondria, this one part of the cell, works. And we're finding some fascinating information. One of the things that we started out looking at was something called mitochondrial disease, is when the mitochondria does not work hard enough. That is, for some reason, part of it is broken. Maybe you can think of it as an eight-cylinder engine with only two cylinders working. And that's classically how we've thought of mitochondrial disease. What we're actually finding is that that does seem to affect about 5% of children with autism. And that's a huge number, because mitochondrial disease affects, it's believed to affect less than 0.1% of the population. But what we're finding in our studies is that there's actually a different type of mitochondrial dysfunction, where the mitochondria actually is working at about 200% capacity for some reason, probably because it's trying to compensate for something else that's going wrong in the cell. And what that does is it makes the mitochondria very vulnerable to outside influences, including things like inflammation or possibly toxins or other types of metabolic imbalances. And what can happen is, if the mitochondria is working that hard and something comes along that can negatively influence, it can fall apart very easily. So we think that that we've found somewhat of a model of a predisposition, that is the mitochondria working very hard, and some type of interaction with possibly the environment, you know, either from inflammation or some type of environmental influence that can make the cell kind of break down or almost have a blackout for some period of time.
Huh, almost like it can't quite, it gets worn out and exhausted from overworking in one area and can't pay attention to another.
Exactly.
Does that relate at all, this research on mitochondria, to gut bacteria and the microbiome research that's going on?
So it's there's really interesting overlaps in many different ways. Evolutionarily, we believe that mitochondria actually were derived from gut bacteria, so that that many of the internal machinery in the mitochondria are not unlike gut bacteria. What we also are learning is that some of those same metabolic processes that are important in the mitochondria are also done by our gut bacteria, and that our gut bacteria actually does some of the metabolic processing of nutrients and other things in our body, even though they're not technically within our body.
Huh. So it's really, are you now working more interdisciplinary in a sense for research on autism? Are you collaborating with people on the genetic side, on the microecologist, as some people call themselves, side? Are you doing much more collaboration than you used to?
Oh, we think that's the only way of really solving the problem. It's clear that that really our way of thinking of disease within a certain focused category of this little piece is broken here or this organ is not working is not the right approach for autism. Autism seems to be something that involves many different systems, many different parts of the body, many different influences. And the only way we're going to solve it is by having a multidisciplinary team. And that's where we've tried to develop. We have our autism clinic actually is a multi-specialty clinic where we try to get as many specialists as needed to see a child at the same time so we can put our heads together and see how everything we see about the child converges and we can choose what the best treatment plan is.
Since there isn't a lot of funding available right now for this type of research, do you find yourself or do you see other people squabbling to get access to money for research?
It is really a major problem. You know, the National Institutes of Health, where we received grants, has really not had a pay raise in several decades, and so the money and the grants that used to be given out for innovative research just aren't making it there, and that has also put a strain on private foundations that would fund innovative research, whereas they may have been able to fund very, you know, preliminary innovative research. Now more established investigators are getting their money from foundations. So the money is not as plentiful as it needs to be.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Dr. Richard Fry. He's a child neurologist and director of autism research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. Dr. Fry, thank you for coming. Thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knavy. Lindsay Knecht is associate producer with help on the phones today from Jose Carrion. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Thanks.